Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Michael Steele, it's such a pleasure to be with you as always. Look forward to having you in the house as we have interesting conversations. I love it when you come and spend some time with us. Certainly, you know, you can find me on the Spreaker app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get the podcast thing on. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And if you really like this episode, please comment it, on it on the Spreaker app. On the Spreaker app, it helps me to know your thoughts and, you know, bring better programming, as they like to say. I was really looking forward to our conversation today because we've got a gentleman who has had an interesting walk and a very important story to tell as a part of that walk. Reginald Dwayne Betts is a poet, a lawyer, and the founding director of Freedom Reads. He's also a 2021 MacArthur Fellow. And his story is born out of lived experiences. And certainly one of his works really kind of tells the story that chronicles his journey from prison to becoming a licensed attorney. He holds a JD from Yale Law School. But his latest poetry collection, Felon, the memoir, A Question of Freedom, is what we're going to get in today. In fact, one of his other works, Bastards of the Reagan Era, I need to check in with his brother on what that, because I hope I'm not one of those bastards. from the Reagan era. Brother needs to come correct if I am. Hey, Dwayne, welcome, brother. Welcome, man. It's so good to have you part of the conversation.
No, it's my pleasure. You know, it's one of those things where when I was younger, I didn't know what my life would shake out to be. And now I find myself sometimes in conversations with people who help my thinking develop and help my thinking grow. And also reminded me that the way different ways that Maryland was on the map, you know, it was like you, and it was I can't even remember his name right now, but he played running back for the New Jersey for the Jets, and he went to University of Maryland, and he went to Lamont Jordan.
Oh, Lamont Jordan, yeah.
So it was you, and it was Lamont Jordan. He went to high school with me, but the point was that y'all were like sort of my touchstones for Maryland existing, and my childhood kind of existing in the public space.
Well, and I appreciate that, brother. And I appreciate you because you know, some people would say, you know, you've done the impossible and you've done the difficult. And I take a different view. You've done what particularly Black men have always done. You've managed to make it work. You've managed to find that space despite the obstacles and the pre-designed, predefined chart for your life, and write your own story in your own way. And that's what a lot of the work that you've done and the poetry that you write is about. But then you sort of encapsulated in Freedom Reads. What is Freedom Reads? What is the inspiration behind it? And how does it connect today for you?
I think It's in some ways simple, and I haven't always described it in this way, but I went to prison when I was 16, and I had planned on being an engineer before I went to prison. I was taking Fortran and C++ and discrete math and pre-calculus, and I didn't really know what it meant to be a computer engineer, which I think is what I was preparing to do.
Right.
But I knew I wanted to go to Georgia Tech, and I was doing relatively well in high school, but these were all myths to me because I didn't know anybody who went to college. And it takes a lot, really, to say that you're going to be something that you can't name, identify, explain, chart a course towards.
Right.
And I didn't, if you would have asked me if I could chart a course towards prison, I would have said yes, but I would have said, who would want to do something like that? You know,
right.
And yet I carjacked somebody and followed a path that's relatively well trodden for some of the folks in my community, not the majority, but for some folks, it was well trodden. And I understood it and knew it and knew to avoid it, but didn't. And I remember after being sentenced to 9 years in prison, I was 16. I just knew that it was important intuitively to want to be somebody, right? And I told myself I would be a writer. And I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea. If you would have asked me what kind of writer do I want to be, I wouldn't have been able to answer. If you would have said poet, novelist, nonfiction, I would have known none of those things. I had never read The New Yorker. I had never read The New York Times Magazine. I had read Walter Mosley. I had read Sherlock Holmes. But the point is that I made this decision to do something. And a conduit for me to figure out how to do that thing, and a conduit for me to remember that I could be more than what I was in terms of a 16-year-old convicted felon, came through literature and came through books. Mm-hmm. And we talk a lot about criminal justice reform, and we talk a lot about advocacy, but a lot of that work is centered towards changing policies that take forever to change. And a lot of that work is centered towards making rhetorical flourishes that aren't even motivated by policy change. Freedom Reads is a project that says what saved me was books. And I spent time in 5 prisons that didn't have books. And I had people around me when I was in prisons with libraries who were afraid to go to the library because they thought they might get hurt from the stretch from their housing unit to the library, or they wanted to play basketball and we didn't have an appropriate amount of time for recreation and library services. Or they worked 9-to-5s. People work 9-to-5s in prison. I worked several 9-to-5s in prison. Some of those I chose to do because they put me adjacent to the library, whether it was working in a law library or working as a GED tutor. But the point is, recognizing that some people don't have access to those books, I wanted to solve that problem by giving folks access to books and beauty. So one, we build these libraries, they're micro libraries. We had a shelving system that was designed by Mass Design in collaboration with us and people from the DOC, but it's beautiful. And it allows you to have this hardwood, natural, handcrafted, set of objects in a space that you look out on from your cell or from your bunk every day. And you could get these 500 wonderfully curated books that came out of my mind, but out of the mind of so many people that I know and admire and have had the good fortune of talking to.
That's powerful, man. I mean, and to create that space for self-improvement, learning, understanding, just growing, is so important, because a lot of folks come into the conversation around prison, especially in the prison reform piece. And I often feel they kind of missed the boat. It's almost like we're going to rehabilitate. we're going to fix the men or the women in the system as much as they are about fixing the system. And a lot of times you just really kind of proved the point. People will fix themselves if given the right tools under the right circumstances and situations. Your example, your story, for me, is very important for a number of reasons. And folks who listen to the podcast know I've talked about Eager Street Academy out of Baltimore City, which was one time the only high school prison, if you will, in the country, in that within that system that housed our 13 to 18 year old boys and young girls, they had a high school setting so that these young individuals could continue to try to self-improve and so forth. And I spent a lot of time as lieutenant governor, actually several times a year during my term in office, visiting those young men in particular and speaking to them. And the one thing I would tell them, Duane, is what your lived experience proves was I'm looking at a 13, 15, 16, 17-year-old boy. I'm saying, don't let this moment define the rest of your life. Just because you're here now doesn't mean this is your future. And you have the power to reorient your walk in any direction you want to when you leave here. Do the time. Yeah, okay. Accountability is an important step in growth and growing up. But that's where you really begin, I think, this idea of self-improvement, when you incentivize and help young individuals in our prison system realize that this isn't definitional. This isn't all of it right here. And you prove that.
Yeah, but I got to tell you the truth. I mean, look, I remember I came home. I was able to vote. It was a stroke of luck. Virginia transferred my parole to Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And because I wasn't from Virginia. And then I did well. I was a college student. I was working full time. But I remember I was having to go take 2 urine tests a month. And I told my PR, I don't understand why I have to take urine tests. I got arrested when I was 16. I wasn't a drug user. I wasn't a drug abuser. And I wasn't even old enough to drink alcohol. I wasn't old enough to smoke. And I work full time and I'm in school full time. And it's just hard for me to get here twice a day. And you know what she told me? She said, you could get here or you could go back to jail. And so I was like, all right, it's cool. I'm going to get there. And I said, well, what's the best way to facilitate this? Because I got an 8 a.m. class at the community college because I work from 9 to 5. And so I'm trying to figure out what to do. And she says, I don't know what you do, but you need to be the first person in line because otherwise you might miss your class and that's on you. And so I would get there, 7:30, 7:15, and wait an extra 45 minutes. So just so that I could know I was the first person that was walking through the door.
Right.
I end up getting my probation transferred to another PO and they canceled it after 3 years. They was like, you're fine. You're good. We think you're in college. You're doing great. You don't cause us any problems. And because I got it canceled, I was able to vote. But the point is, so much of these decisions were happenstance. And I was just fortunate to have it transferred from one person to another person who was willing to think, I'm going to these people and I'm saying, I need to go to this poetry workshop. Is it okay? I never heard of a poetry workshop.
Right.
And they don't think that I'm gonna make the connections that lead me to get a fellowship at Harvard to write poems. And it's just that I got the right young PO that said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And it makes little sense to me. But you telling me that the PG Arts Council gave me $1,500 to fly to Massachusetts. And this was the start of I met a poet who said, you should go to graduate school now. And I was like, but I don't have an undergraduate degree. She said, you're good. And if you want to write, you could write and you should go now. So my point is that when I say it's happenstance, is I ended up going to graduate school at the same time I went to University of Maryland. So I got a full tuition scholarship to both institutions at the same time, but it was almost happenstance. It was just knocking on a lot of doors and accepting a lot of people telling me that I am only the thing I was when I pulled the gun on somebody at 16. I mean, even Howard University, I had a full tuition academic scholarship. They didn't read my application. I put my heart on the page and explained to them that I wanted to go to Howard because no matter what anybody else said, the community that I hurt the most with my crimes was not Fairfax County, Virginia. Although I'm sure that I hurt that community and my victim and his family and their families, right? But I was like, I hurt my community because my little cousin went to prison 2 years after me. I had friends who went to prison after me. Mm-hmm. I was a part of the sort of group of people who set a model to say this is what's possible. And I was like, I want to go to Howard to say that something else is possible. Because my scholarship was guaranteed, nobody even read the essay. And then when I went to sign the paper to accept admission, it was a box I had to check.
Yep.
And when I pulled them into the room to talk about the box, my scholarship disappeared. Yep. They never told me no. They just never talked to me again.
Yeah.
And so I went to University of Maryland and I got a full tuition academic scholarship there. And I graduated and was the commencement speaker. But again, it's like, how do you focus on both parts of the story? I don't want to dwell on being rejected by Howard, but I want to remember that some of those young folks who were at that juvenile detention center came home and didn't have the fortitude, didn't have the family support, didn't have the natural abilities that I might have. And so, they suffered and we blame them for their suffering.
Right.
And what I try to do is like, how do I fill the gaps? I don't want to perseverate over who deserves to be blamed, but I want to ask myself, how can I fill the gap? Because ultimately, we need more people that's willing to say yes to people who have faced challenges in the past.
Well, you make a point that I made often when I would speak to groups, and particularly whether it was certainly business leaders, but even those who tangentially touch on our prison network and the dealing with recidivism and other issues related to incarcerated individuals who are trying to find a footing to come out and start their lives new. You know, there's a general perception, which I'm sure you know, have run into. And I know folks in my own family and friends who've run into this, that when they've left prison, the expectation is, okay, so when are you going back? Right. And so the system is set up to almost put you back on that path without any obvious efforts to move you along a direction that while you were incarcerated, you decided you wanted to go. I want to reform my life. I want to do these things. I want to go in this direction. You raise an interesting point that I'm curious about in that in dealing with your PO and in dealing with the system and those in it who seemingly at every corner were, okay, well, I don't care how you solve this problem. You just need to go figure it out. What was it that kept you focused in the face of a PO telling you, well, you just better be the first in line. And I don't care if you got a 9 a.m. class. If you miss this or you don't do that, you're going back to jail or whatever. Sort of tearing down the dream and the expectation of the dream, as opposed to helping you figure out a better way to move towards that dream. And in the end, you ultimately did. But to your point, there are those who come out who don't. What? How did you face that?
To be honest, I had, I do think, you know, part of me heard them and thought, I gotta make sure that the world's understanding of me doesn't comport with this thing that they're saying. Now, I went to prison when I was a kid, and when I got sentenced, I had a bunch of family members, you know, two or three, four people that testified before the judge begging for mercy, explaining that I committed the crime because I didn't have a father in the house. And my mom was in the audience. She didn't speak for me that day. She had, she say she had bronchitis, and I know she gets bronchitis, but the truth is that, you know, broken heart could steal your voice sometimes. Right. And I remember, I was a fool, right? I'm 16, think I know everything. And the judge says, do you have anything to say? And I stand up and I say, well, Your Honor, I didn't commit the crime because I didn't have a father in the house. Now, I don't fully know why I did it. And I apologize to, you know, and I apologize, but... Mm-hmm. But I wasn't willing to walk into a room and have somebody take the blame for my failures. And I really wasn't willing to do it because essentially that argument was saying that my mother wasn't enough.
Right.
And right. So I come home and when people are like closing doors in my face or even when I'm just trying to figure out how to deal with the world, because my peers are also, I mean, the people that I want to be around have college degrees. Right. I'm 24. I'm in community college. They're like, you know, and if you meet a stranger and they're like, yo, what are you doing with your life? And I'm like, oh, I work at Caribou. And they're like, you work in retail?
Retail, right. You know?
And I'm like, I like my job, right? So one of the things I did, and it probably started with Caribou. I met Yao Glover, who was one of the owners of Caribou, and mm-hmm. he was selling books at Bowie State. And he had all of these books up and I read all of them, you know, we just kicking it about books. And he's like, oh, where'd you go to college? And I'm like, oh, no, I ain't go to college. He's like, oh, so where you at? Where you go? You about to graduate? I'm like, nah. And he looked young. And mind you, I just got out of prison. So I've been in prison since I was a child, and prison preserves a lot of dudes inside. Yeah. I have no sense of what age is. Right.
Right.
And so
right.
I think that I think he's my peer. So I'm like, I ain't got to be ashamed in front of him. So I tell right. him, man, look, I just got out of prison. You asking me all these questions about college, right? He say, oh, so you a poet? And the question blew my mind because right. out of everybody I met when I first came home, this was sort of like the first person that pivoted from prison to possibility. And I ended up getting this job at Caribou and it opened my eyes to a lot. But the point is, what pushed me away from just being taken down by those no's was desiring to do something that would make my mom proud. And in some ways, you know, I've done it. And in some ways that in doing it, I have like just not been the best son. You know, I've been sort of singly motivated to make myself into somebody. And that meant that, you know, she wouldn't say this, but she might've lost me twice. You know, yeah. She lost me to prison and then she lost me to everything I've done to try to make up. for prison, which has led me to move from Maryland to Boston to, you know, to New Haven. Such is life.
How does she see that? Those each side of that coin of that is her son. The prison side, the 16-year-old boy, and as you aptly put, you know, the preservation of that child during that time, you know, now out and now in this position where you are winning awards, you are a Yale-trained attorney, you have written expressively through poetry about life. How does she process that for you?
I think I was on the front page of the Washington Post in like 2006, right? And they were doing I started a book club at Caribou Books called Young Men Read.
Right.
And when the reporter was fact checking it, I told her, she said, did you graduate from high school? I said, yes. And she said, where? I said, it's complicated. Because I got my high school diploma when I got locked up. I was able to transfer to a Virginia school and essentially skip the 12th grade and go to prison. And so when the reporter found this out that, you know, I had these extra credits and I was able to graduate early, she really wanted to write about prison. But I was like, nah, you know, my mom had to deal with me being in prison for 8.5 years. And I don't want that to be what I'm known for once free. And so after 2 weeks of going back and forth, the reporter killed the story. And then Lonnie Parker, who was the person who passed it to her, I ran into her again and she asked me what happened. And I told her that my mom didn't want the story to run. And so she said, can I talk to your mom? And she talked to my mom, and I don't even know what that conversation was, but Lanae ended up picking up the story and doing it, and it was on the front page of the Post. My mom called me crying. She was like, I thought it was going to be in the back of the Metro section. It's on the front page. You know? And I was like, I didn't know. But when you asked me what does my mom think about it, I think that was the first moment where my mom thought that what I might become was as important as, and not just to her, because what I might become was always important to her. But at that moment, she thought that what I might become could be just as important to the public. And then, you know, this is 2006. I hadn't even really been home for just a little more than a year. After that, I think that when she thinks about what I've done, she's, you know, she feels like she had to share some with prison and she has to share some with the world. And I'm certain she feels better sharing her son with the world than she sharing her son with prison.
I'm sure she does. So let's get into the poetry. Wanted to go with the Lord might have given him wings. And it goes just a little bit, folks, to give you a feel of Dwayne's touch here. There was something wrong with him, our poor thing. And if prison is where Black men go to become Lazarus or to become Jonah, this kid must already have wings. They call it inevitable, everything after that hour's confession, the silences and walls that drown the living, and what of his victims, their skin as dark as the night. No one calls him kid, the arms he slides in a sweater for protection against the cold, slender enough to fit in the fist of a large man is what I mean. His hands large enough to grip the black of the pistol to squeeze the quiver of a trigger, the holy have left, we know. And the kid, his halo, a mess of hurt, the daffodils of poverty and the ones who abandoned him, his sentence, a cataclysm of the guns he pulled and the dirt shrouded dead teenagers in cities he's never known. Where they name mass incarceration, he will be amongst the number and the victim's mother, her black invisible against the subtext of her son's coffin, will be on the outside of advocacy. Just that part of it, when I read it, I could visualize so many different scenes of not just your life as I could imagine it in your words, but the lives of a Trayvon Martin, for example, my own sons. How do you come to capture that in the poetry? Because that's work, folks. That is work.
Yeah, I think,
forgive my reading of it.
That was good. It was good.
Yeah, go ahead.
I tell people that I learned how to think by writing, and I might not be as compassionate or even eloquent or even able to notice the broad range of things in the world when I talk, because I got priors that might lead me to move in one direction. But when I sit down and write, I have to try to take it all in. And so, you know, that particular poem, I mean, I was thinking about the fact that many of the victims of the crimes that I committed or the people I know committed look just like me.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, we have, so one of those scenes about his mother, you know, the subtext is her son's coffin and she is on the outside of advocacy. I represent men right now trying to get them out on parole. And I deeply believe that they've served enough time in prison. And I also understand that it's the mother of somebody's child who was gone that is on the other side of this conversation. And I'm thinking about that poem is me thinking about, if I acknowledge that, then what does it demand that I do? What does it demand that my friends do? You know, the people that I work with and I try to get out to. And that poem is just trying to be as complicated as the world is. And actually, one of the reasons why I love poetry, so much more difficult to do in prose, and writing for any mainstream publication, is poetry allows you to not have to answer. You know, people always want to say, what do you mean? And it's like, what if what I mean is that it's complicated? What if what I mean is that at the end of the day, I got another poem in there that says, and we were too tired to be beautiful. You know, and what does it mean? Like, and we was too powerless to stop it. Mm-hmm. And too tired to be beautiful, which is a kind of admission that I think that we don't often say publicly. And so we keep imagining that we had the answers and so we end up not doing the work to really figure out some of the more complex answers around crime and violence and incarceration. It doesn't become a part of the public discourse in a way in which the critiques of the system do or the critiques of the people do.
Poetry Collection is Felon, the memoir, A Question of Freedom, and the author and imaginer, if you will, is Reginald Dwayne Betts. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more with this incredible author right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to Michael Steele Podcast. And I want to reengage in our conversation with Reginald Dwayne Betts and his new work, collection of poems, Felon, the memoir, A Question of Freedom. So as you were talking about before we went to break, how a lot of times we don't come with honesty with about the situation, the circumstance, the condition, and we're too tired and we're not willing to admit how tired we are. And that tiredness is probably related to, okay, here we go again, another scenario, a moment, another thing that's just like the one before it. And we sort of give up in the process, but you don't, and you didn't. You found a way, despite the circumstances, to pull yourself through this and not give up and give in to the traditional notion that, well, this is all I can do and I can go no further. How did you get to a point where you became comfortable enough to talk about your incarceration, to talk about that period, and to put it in words that, generationally speaking, will last time? I mean, that's the beauty of poetry, like a lot of different writing. It will speak in a different moment from now. How did you get comfortable creating that space?
You know, it's interesting because when I was in prison, so I got locked up in 1996, which is, pre-laptop computer,
right,
pre-iPhone, basically pre-explosion of the internet. And I came home to a completely different world. But when I was inside, I expected to leave prison completely behind when I came home. Nobody was talking about prison reform, really, in any kind of robust way that I heard while I was in prison. And my family wasn't hearing it. It just wasn't a subject of conversation. Virginia had you know, got rid of parole like many other states in the early 90s and the mid 90s. And so I thought that I was in a time warp and that my duty was to do my time and survive and leave all of it behind me. I had no intention of ever talking about prison. I had an intention of going to college. I went to the University of Maryland. Like, I came home on March 4th, and April, I was in the counselor's office at University of Maryland. And he was like, I was like, yeah, I'm trying to enroll. And he said, okay, but, you know, we already got the class of 2009. Chosen. And I was like, that's cool, because I want to go now. Remember, I got locked up my junior year of high school. So, right, I didn't even understand the language of a class, because I wasn't a part of the class. And he said, no, but we've already chosen I was like, I want to start now. He was like, no, we've chosen the students. He was like, we're already in the second semester. I was a high school student the last time in school. I was like, what is a semester, you know?
Right. And he's sitting there looking at you like, why are you not getting what I'm saying?
Right. And then I get frustrated. And I say, you know what, man, look, I wasn't going to tell you this, but I just got out of prison. I got locked up when I was 16. I did 8 years. And I told my peoples I was going to go to college. I told myself I was going to go to college. So I'm here. And he looked at me and said, oh, how old are you? And I tell him, he said, well, look, you don't have to take the SAT test. I was like, that's not my biggest concern, you know?
On the list of priorities.
Right. SAT. He was like, you know, they only do the test in a certain time of year. And this means that since you don't have to take it, you could start in August. I was like, great, I could start here. He was like, no, you can't start here, but you could start at community college. And that's how I ended up going to community college, right? And so what happens is then I go to community college and I take this test and I test in an honors English, but you got to get a teacher to sign off on it. And I go to her class and she's like, her name is Dr. Melinda Frederick. Her name is Dr. Melinda Frederick. She says, yeah, for somebody who's so smart, why are you starting school so late? And I had wrote, the first article I wrote was about being a juvenile, about juveniles being locked up in prison with adults, and right. I published it, and I would carry it around with me just in case I needed to prove my intelligence. I thought having a published piece of writing proved something.
Right, right.
And so she says that, and I show her the piece, and I tell her, look, I was in prison, but, you know, I'm a writer, and I'm just trying to go to school. And she was like, you must have did something that was really crazy to go to prison at 16. And I was like, yeah, maybe. And so she signs the paper, and I go to community college. And then I met Yao, and I end up telling Yao. And again, I don't want to tell these people, but like, I was terrified in prison, but I stayed in general population. I met friends. I was loved in prison too. You know, I got a lot of friends that I met in prison. So I was just like, I wasn't willing to keep constantly erasing that past, because right. I didn't have anything to fill it with anyway. And I just didn't want to like run from it. And the last time I told somebody, I was in this class, I'm doing well, I got A's so far. It was Dr. Corey Haynes, and he taught African-American history. And I'm in this class, and this kid is giving all of these cliches about men in prison, and about how we come home just to get locked back up again, and how we like spreading diseases. And I was like, man, you don't know what you're talking about. And I didn't say it that politely either. I was just like,
I know you did.
And he was like, how
personal.
You know?
That yeah. point, it's personal. Yeah.
And he was like, and mind you, the whole class is quiet now, you know? And honestly, I come home when I'm 24, but I'm in shape. 24 looks like 20, really, you know?
Right.
So they don't know me. And I say, cause I just came home during 8 years. That's how I know. How you know? And then the professor was like, all right, calm down, folks. Let's move on. And then at the end of class, he was like, Mr. Betts, you mind staying after for a second? And I'm like, oh, they about to kick me out of college, you know? And he talks to me, and he shares a bit of his story and how he had ran into a little bit of trouble when he went to community college and then went to Howard and then went to Oxford. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly, and he's telling me, you know, like you could do something with your life, no matter what somebody says. And he's like, you know, and you could actually talk about prison and do some good in the world too. And so all of that led to me being less afraid of talking about it in my personal life. And in my public life, I just met somebody classmate from middle school invited me to speak at her PhD class that she was teaching. Mm-hmm. She was a PhD student and was teaching a class at the University of Maryland. I go to speak at her class and I happen to meet Liz Ryan, mm-hmm. who ran a campaign for Youth Justice. And she heard me tell my story and was like, I think you should come talk to these folks. And then I ended up doing congressional briefings and, you know, speaking at different advocacy events. And I was with Charles S. Dutton and some other folks. I was featured in
my buddy brief. Charles. Yeah.
Yeah. And we was in this amicus brief for Graham v. Florida that said that you can't send a juvenile to prison for life. I faced life. And it's like, you can't send a juvenile to prison for life for a non-homicide offense. Mm-hmm. And so all of that's to say that it wasn't planned. I thought I was going to come home and go to college and be a writer. And I didn't know what that meant. And then I thought when I learned a little bit more that I would teach poetry, none of that stuff panned out. Never planned on going to law school, but, you know, opportunities came and I kept trying to find a way to pivot when sort of opportunities didn't pan out. And going to law school, in fact, was me just like pivoting from not being able to get a job, not even being able to get an interview on the teaching market. I just decided if I was going to be an unemployed convict, I might as well be an unemployed convict with a Harvard law degree.
Join the ranks of those other Harvard lawyers without a job.
And then I went to Yale. I went to Yale because I was like, Yale is going to ensure that I get a job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in 2019, you win the National Magazine Award in the Essays and Criticism category for Getting Out, which was the essay that you did that really documented your journey from prison to becoming an attorney. You also had the work that I was curious about. It was Bastards of the Reagan Era. So let's set the record straight. as a Black Republican, I am of the Reagan Era. So I just want to make sure I get my bastard credentials on correctly. What was that about? What was the nature of that?
But it wasn't really like a lot of times it's interesting too, because we think about, you know, and bastards being like fatherless children, but in fact, the Bastards of Reagan era, like my dad, I was born in 80. Mm-hmm. So that's the Reagan era. But truly the sort of fatherlessness that I'm talking about, and actually like the unmoored lack of community that I'm talking about in terms of these narratives, they come in a generation that would be like my children, really.
Right.
They come in a generation. I was writing that when I was teaching in Southeast D.C. at Hart Middle School. And one of the things I was grappling with was that I was of a generation where a lot of my friends, myself included, our fathers weren't around. But then I think I came home to that being, you know, repeating in some kind of way. But I wasn't trying to just talk about fatherlessness, right? I had been at a museum and I saw that they call it an elephant graveyard, but it's not really an elephant graveyard because elephants ain't moving their bones anywhere. Right. And they found the same thing with woolly mammoths. And what it is when it's like some huge disaster that's about to happen, the reason why you find all of these giant animals in the same place is because they circle the young.
That's right.
And when a disaster falls, it hits everybody. Man, wasn't nobody arguing that I shouldn't go to prison because I got the potential of being a Yale lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. And it wasn't just like, and my family was arguing, but they weren't necessarily equipped with the narratives that explained it because they had been beaten over their head with the narratives of lack and with the narratives of impossibility as well. But what I really am saying is the Bastards of Reagan era was this generation of young folks who, in the face of really challenging circumstances, and this is not about saying accountability should be thrown to the wind.
Right.
This is about saying that nobody ever told me I could be me.
Right.
And we should be ashamed of that. Forget the fact that because the way people try to make it better by saying I'm an exception. Well, like, I'm not an exception.
Right.
I am just the one that I'm talking about my teachers. When I was a high school student at Suitland High School, was predicting that I was going to end up dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I had like internal resources and a good household. Imagine what they said to people who had none of those things.
Right.
You know, and so the story, it didn't even a critique of like, you know, Black Reaganites, you know, it's not a critique of conservatives.
Oh, I know.
You know, some people think it is though, and they think it is. But if you read, well, I mean, you'll see in a poem, The Invention of Crack, I talk about how complex it is because it is the folks in the Black community just calling it a scourge. And it is a really complicated issue. I mean, my folks, some of my folks, you know, succumb to drug addiction. And so, like, when Biggie say, yeah, call the police on me, I was just trying to feed my family. I'm like, I don't know. You was trying to, you know, you was trying to ruin my family with drugs. You know, it's more complicated than just, you know, somebody calling the police on you because you was trying to feed your family. So with that collection of poems, I try to explore it in its complication, like I do with all of my work. You know,
before I let you scoot, what in this new work, Felon, what is it you want the reader to personalize for themselves? How do you want them to come into reading this work and walking away from it?
You know, right now when I build these freedom libraries, I work closely with the people in the Department of Corrections. And I find myself constantly telling critics who like to criticize the DOC that, listen, that warden is not a politician. Yeah. The CO is closer to my life than you are. And talking about my peers who are lawyers and advocates and like writers, I'm like, my family's life is closer to that CO's life than yours is. And that CO's life is far closer to my homie who's done 20 years than yours is. And my work is really trying to argue that true change and true, you know, substantive conversation comes from not boxing people in to like easily identifiable categories. What does it mean to really see somebody and have to grapple with what it is that you see? I write in the first person a lot. Some people say they think that every story I had a line in Bastards of the Reagan Era that said, I once sold crack to pregnant women. And a reviewer said, it's really brave of you to admit that you sold crack to pregnant women. And I was like, I don't even know what crack looks like. You know, my father said, I read your book, son. And you have, I don't know how you know these things, because I know your mama raised you better than that. You don't know any of this from experience. And I was like, I know, you know, but the point is that I say I, because if I implicate myself in the worst failings of society, then I believe that I'm putting a step forward to try to implicate myself in some of those solutions. And so if I want somebody to walk away from that work and ask themselves, when they read that poem out loud and they have to embody some of the best and the worst of human conditions, I hope that they walk away from it saying, even if this dude sold crack to pregnant women, it's something that's redeemable here. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever the circumstances that the poems recount, whatever the stories that they get recounted in his work. And you know, that's what I want. I want people to walk away thinking about what does it mean to empathize and to share humanity that we have more than find ways to indict us for our individual decisions.
That's a powerful statement. And it's kind of hard to do in these times when we're being torn every which way possible as a culture, as a society. And when we're forced not to accept responsibility, we're forced not to use the I word in terms of, this is my way of taking responsibility of this situation, this condition, as I want to take responsibility for improving it going forward. It's now more of a selfishness. It's I was not responsible for that. I had no control over that. I have no connection to it. And this work stands in contrast to that when you stop and think about it.
I mean, I'll just say this, you know, I wrote the piece about Kamala Harris and I got a lot of flack and I thought it was pretty dope. I mean, I thought one, I wrote about a vice presidential candidate and the piece is called Kamala Harris, My Mother and Me.
Right.
And what I did in the piece is I really explored, my mother got sexually assaulted, you know, like a couple of weeks after I got incarcerated. And she didn't tell me until I came home. Wow. And we didn't talk about it again for a decade later. And the piece is thinking about the prosecutor's role in protecting people, and particularly in protecting Black women who don't often get protection. What I've tried to do consistently with my work is like grapple with those complexities and those realities. And I mm-hmm. think sometimes it's convenient not to, but as a writer, I've tried to frame every conversation that I've had that is trying to, you know, go at the thing that matters the most, which is the thing that is uncomfortable to talk about. And I like to say that my work, if you read my work, I like to believe that people won't read what they expect to read. Yeah. Like literally, you know, people like, I know what he's going to say about Kamala Harris. This dude was in prison. I know exactly what he's going to say about Kamala Harris. And then by the time they get to the end of the piece, they say, oh.
That's not what I thought at all. Right.
And like, how do I sit with that? Right now, I hire prosecutors. Connecticut is the only state in the union where they have a civilian board that hires the prosecutors. And so we hire all of the prosecutors, which means for the past 2-3 years, I have hired every elected prosecutor and every line prosecutor, right? Mm-hmm. I've hired every like DA, but in Connecticut, it's called state's attorney. Mm-hmm. But I've also hired the line prosecutors that do the work. And it's just meant that I have had to think about how I'm accountable for all of it.
Yeah, you
know, I'm accountable for when people get sent to jail, and I'm accountable for when people get set free. And I think we could all do that, but it's a lift, and it means going against the grain a bit. So,
well, you do that in a way that, as you noted, makes people not only think but place themselves in those stories, in those narratives, in a way that, you know, they walk away a little bit better enlightened and understanding, not just of what happened to you and your story, but how that also reflects on them and how they are reflecting that back. And I just think it's such a good work. And I really highly recommend it to the folks who tune into my podcast. You know, I try to bring brothers and sisters who are cutting edge in a way that forces us to hold the mirror up and hold it closer. Sometimes people hold the mirror up and it's out like,
yeah. And they be having bad eyes too.
Right. They got bad. So they hold the mirror up and it's extended. But you know, when you extend your arms out, and you hold the mirror up, you got all this other stuff that the mirror is capturing that you can look to and explain away. But when you're holding it close, it's just your face, baby. It's just you. And Reginald Dwayne Betts makes us hold that mirror close in his latest poetry collection, Felon, the memoir, A Question of Freedom. Thanks, man, for coming in and sharing a little bit of yourself and your journey with all of us.
Now, it was a pleasure. Like I said, you didn't make me want to run to be a politician, but you made me know it was possible. And so I appreciate that.
I didn't scare you away from it, right?
Yeah, no, I was inside. I was like, man, I was like, I could be, and I thought Lieutenant Governor was really like the person that ran everything. I just knew that the governor wasn't.
Yeah, we
kind of
do. We kind of do.
Yeah. But it's a pleasure, man. I appreciate the time.
No, I appreciate you, man. And again, I recommend Felon, the memoir, Question of Freedom, to everyone.
Oh, and yep. We got an event at the National Building Museum on March 4th. So we talked about the Freedom Library, but on March 4th, I don't know when it's the air, but on March 4th, we have the actual structure of the Freedom Library, the actual thing that we build in prisons. It's going to be an exhibit at the National Building Museum. And we're going to have and reveal the 500 books that's in the collection for the first time. And the books range from, you know, Black Boy, Richard Wright, to Faulkner, to Cervantes, to Toni Morrison, to Louise Eldridge. Poetry, fiction, nonfiction, got a little bit of romance in there, got some sci-fi, but it's a beautiful collection and it'll get revealed for the first time on March 4th, 2022 at the National Building Museum from 6 to 9 p.m.
Well, that's good to know. And this will come out a little bit before March 4th, but what we will do is we will put it back in rotation and promote the exhibit with that collection on March 4th as well. So perfect. I appreciate you sharing that with the audience. Again, check out the book of poetry, the collection. Also check out the work that you'll see at the museum. So I appreciate you, man, coming on. Like I said, it really is inspiring stuff. And anything I can do to help promote that, I'm all about it. So, you keep it real as you do. Folks, that does it for this part of our conversation. You know, we're going to have it again because we always do. And I love it when you tune in and spend some time with us. You can find us again on the Spreaker app, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast on. Follow me on Twitter @Michael Steele. And definitely follow Dwayne on Twitter at Dwayne Betts. And straight up, you can also tag him to remind you to go check out the exhibit. And if you like this episode, please comment on it on the Spreaker app. It helps me to know how you feel about what I'm doing. As always, take care of yourselves. Until next time, be safe, be well. If you haven't gotten the vax, do that. If you haven't gotten your booster, do that. And we're bringing down the masks soon. So there's hope, folks. There's light. There's That's light. Right. So until next time, later.
America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
I'm Dr. Andrew Jacobs, host of the Sports Psychology Hour. Is your New Year's resolution to become stronger, healthier, and more resilient? Then start with the Rewire Fitness Neuro Performance app. Rewire Fitness takes a holistic approach to achieving peak performance, letting you strengthen both your body and mind with Rewire's integrated resilience training system. Go to winnersunlimited.com/rewire. Click Learn More to sign up for your free 7-day trial of Rewire Fitness. That's winnersunlimited.com/rewire.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.